fate, and it's all that I got. So you better understand before you start your invasion. You better think twice before you start your enslaving. This is my world. It belongs to me.
I want some credit for enslaving and what was the other thing I said? Enslaving and invading. Thank you, invading. I don't even remember what I said. Anyway, come on, huh? Yeah. Enslaving, invasion, or enslaving. That's pretty cool, huh? Okay.
Get off my world. It belongs to me, everybody. Get off my world. You can mumble this part. Is there any me? Get off my world. If you don't, you're gonna get it. Get off my world, or I'm gonna bury you in it.
And then let's just sing Get Off My World a bunch of times. Ready? 3, 4.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
A little louder for the folks at home. That was rousing. Great job.
Ladies and gentlemen, live from the Bryant Lake Bowl Theater in Minneapolis, it's Get Off My World, a Doctor Who podcast featuring temporal troubadour Pablo Jones. Local theatrical luminaries Shannon Custer, Ariel Leaf, and Clarence Weathern. City Pages theater critic Ed Hike. TV and film critic Michael McDonough, a.k.a. the unaffiliated critic. And, of course, the hosts of our podcast, Pat Harrigan, Calvin Hatley, and Joshua English Scrimshaw.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Calvin.
And this, like we said, is Get Off My World. We are three grown-ass men with lives and families and legitimate careers and hobbies, and still we love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series too. We'll take you through 5 rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show.
But first, let's introduce tonight's honorary co-host. Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Chicago, Illinois, the unaffiliated critic Michael McDonough. So, Mike, you were our very first guest on Get Off My World, the podcast.
I was. It was a tremendous honor.
Well, thank you for coming back. Will you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your website?
Sure. I am, much like yourself, a recovering lit major and thwarted academic who has chosen to put his nefarious talents towards TV and movies. I write about both at unaffiliatedcritic.com. And Doctor Who and Game of Thrones are really my bread and butter. Those are my most consistent shows. So that's what I do.
Excellent. Thank you. And you will talk a lot about Doctor Who, but not much about Game of Thrones tonight. I'm sorry.
Next
week. Okay. And now it's time for round one, temporal grace. We like to open each podcast with something that makes us happy about Doctor Who. Tonight we're going to do something crazy, though. We're going to start with something that makes us happy about new Doctor Who. All right. Specifically, the very new season of Doctor Who, Series 9, which just premiered a few days ago with The Magician's Apprentice by Stephen Moffat. And can I hear maybe by round of some sort of noise who hasn't seen this episode yet? Okay, we're going to start with a plot breakdown and tell you everything that... No, we will try to keep this a little spoiler light, but what we're going to talk about here is what made us happy about this first episode and what we are anticipating about this new series. Let's start with Michael.
I will say what makes me happy about this new season is, and it begins with this first episode, it is largely two-parters, which makes me very happy. So it's going back to that classic Doctor Who formula of longer stories. Two episodes in the current timing works out to about 4 episodes in the old series. So we're getting these longer stories, a little more room to breathe. Very happy about that. especially since Stephen Moffat has a tendency to put way too many things into a single story. So yeah. I'm hoping it'll spread it out a little more.
Pat?
Well, I'll be a little shallow and just call out all of the fun fan service in the first episode. I made notes. I counted references to Genesis of the Daleks, also UNIT. There was an Ood. I love the Ood. The Shadow Proclamation, the Jadoon, the Sisterhood of Karn, the references to three different types of Atlantises, all of the old Daleks, and, of course, all of the 1960s Ray Cusick design for the Dalek corridors. So.
Wait, Pat, I'm confused because you just said you love the Ood. You do realize that's a new series creation.
I make an exception for the Ood.
Okay.
And the 12th Doctor was wearing the First Doctor's pants.
I don't think he took them from the First Doctor.
Yeah. But, he actually surprised himself back in 1964. Whoops! And then just ran off with his pants. But I'd like to think he did that. Doctor pantsing himself.
Is that what you liked about the episode, Calvin? The idea that he pantsed William Hartnell?
What's not to like?
As long as we're speaking about...
Pants.
Pants and William Hartnell. Which are basically the same topic. I liked the little promotional video that was online to promote the new series that had Waris Hussein touring the TARDIS set. I don't know if you guys saw this, but Peter Capaldi was basically showing Waris Hussein around the TARDIS set. And who's Waris Hussein? Waris Hussein was the first guy who ever directed Doctor Who. He directed An Unearthly Child in 1963. Aww. And he's got to be... I figure like 70 or 75 years
old. So he had no idea where he was. They were just
No. I mean, he looked like he was about 40.
Mm.
And I was just figured like, wow, life treated Waris Hussein pretty good. I just thought that was nice.
We'll make that a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Well, what about you, Josh?
Okay, my favorite thing so far about Series 9 is my wife. Because as a married guy, your favorite part about everything should be your wife. But recently, Adrienne, my wife, read Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman, which is a novelization of a TV show that Neil Gaiman wrote, which also featured Peter Capaldi, the current Doctor, as the Angel Islington. And Adrienne pointed out to me, and was very happy about this, that Neil Gaiman, in his book, describes the role that Peter Capaldi played as... an angel of astonishing, perfectly androgynous beauty. And so every time I sit down to watch the new Doctor Who, Adrienne says, oh, there he is, that angel of perfect androgynous beauty. Even when she's not there, that's all I hear in my head. Which, if you haven't seen Peter Capaldi, he is not. I love the man. But he is not.
So, you guys... As long as we're talking about Peter Capaldi, I don't know if you know this, but we're good friends, Peter and me.
Oh!
Yeah, we grew up together. We hang out.
Into the podcast and we find this out.
Yeah. Sorry, he asked me to keep it quiet, but it's okay now. But recently...
Were you in that band with Craig Ferguson with him or
something? I don't talk about that. Anyway, Peter has graciously allowed us to share some of the more interesting fan letters he receives now as Doctor Who, and we're going to read them out for you tonight on this program. Dear Mr. Capaldi, as a grandfather of several young children who love your program, I recently decided to familiarize myself with your work as the new Doctor Who. I have never been a fan myself, although I am aware of the basic elements of regeneration, time travel, etc., etc. However, after viewing, I have grown quite distressed by what I have seen, and I do not think that the language or subject matter of this program is at all suitable for the children of Britain. Take, for example, the very first episode I watched, which must have been a very early one of yours. It started promisingly, a late 20th century period story with high-powered guest star Hugh Grant, and a plot concerning a monstrous prehistoric snake cult and other spooky shenanigans, reminiscent of the Tom Baker classics of years past. But I do not understand why the producers would include a scene in which a leather underwear-clad snake woman gives fatal fellatio to a nude Boy Scout in a hot tub. Really, sir? Is that appropriate for tea time? Perhaps this was an aberration, I thought, an unusually blue episode, so I decided to sample some further adventures. After some initial confusion, in which I watched a rather eccentric story that it turned out did not star you, but rather Mr. Richard E. Grant, who I am told plays the Ninth Doctor and having something to do with people turning into bugs, I dipped into a later story arc, set in contemporary times among the movers and shakers of Whitehall. I forget the exact nature of the crisis, but the doctor has arrived to sort things out. So far, so good, but was it really necessary to describe the situation in the following way? Well, half an hour ago, you were in with a shot. This is half an hour hence. We've effing time-traveled, yes? We're in a weird and wonderful world where everything is different. Maybe outside, the polar ice caps have melted. Maybe there's effing robots knocking about, and Davina McCall's the new pope. Maybe you can download rice. Or to tell someone, I will tear your effing skin off. I will wear it to your mother's birthday party and rub your bleeps up and down her leg whilst whistling Bohemian effing Rhapsody, all right? Deplorable, sir. Hilarious, but deplorable. Finally, space restricts me from even mentioning the shocking scenes starring your young companion played by Miss Jenna Jameson. I will not be allowing my grandchildren to watch your program any longer. Yours sincerely, etc.
I think that guy put his finger right on why the ratings are up.
Yeah. Yeah, too bad Ken Russell isn't still alive. You could direct a few Doctor Who episodes. There's a reference no one got.
That's way to go back for it, though.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, introduce round two for us.
Okay, sure. It's round two, special topics, Dalek. Today's special topic is, when did Doctor Who make you the angriest? And here, for this segment, we have our special guest, Ariel Leaf.
Now, you'll notice that we didn't phrase this as, has Doctor Who ever made you angry? There's just sort of this assumption as a Doctor Who fan that the show you love will make you just frothing angry at some point.
There is the assumption, in fact, that if you are on this podcast, you are passionate enough that there are many, many, many things that have made you angry. I thought about just stringing them all together, like just breaking the rules and just spitting them out in one long string. But then I decided that wasn't as much fun as making fun of the new Doctor Who. So
why don't we just let you tear out with this? What makes you really, really angry?
Well, it being the new Doctor Who, there's probably a number of things that I could have come up with. But really nothing, you know, lit the neon sign so much as, oh my God, the love story between Rose and the 10th Doctor. Oh my bleeping God, why? So,
would you like to expand on that?
I can expand on it for a number of reasons. I mean, I think number one, as a woman watching Doctor Who, that was really the last thing I personally wanted to see, was to see a companion taken out of the role of this sort of equal and co-fighter and co-pilot and put into this gooey, melty-eyed role. But there's three real specific reasons that it bothers me. Number one, the reason it bothers me is it changes the Doctor for us. It changes the nature of the relationship with the companions. Up until this point, it's really been a very, with a few exceptions, a very trusting, kind of pure thing in which you just really, that really never ever crossed my mind. I just never thought, ooh, what if those two hook up together? That's just not a thing that happened when I watched Doctor Who. So,
and now Doctor Who makes you feel dirty.
It just makes me kind of sad. Like, oh, is this cool plot line going to end in another? Oh, yes, it is. Okay. Number two, and this is not restricted to Doctor Who, but specialized here, is the age differential. I mean, whether you're even just going with the visual age differential of a 19-year-old girl with what looks to be a 30-something man, okay, that's not real great. But when it's a 19-year-old and a 903-year-old man, that's really gross. Like, that's just, you know, and that one leads kind of right into my third issue, which is a power issue. The Doctor has all of the power. She pisses him off. He can just dump her on a planet and just leave her there.
Or go back in time and do something different.
Or go back in time and do something different. Or go back in time and manipulate her into being the kind of woman he wants her to be. Or and that's just, that's not something that should be presented as a healthy relationship. And then she settles for the cast-off Doctor. I mean, it's not even the Doctor. It's like sort of the Doctor, kind of the Doctor. Well, the Doctor that's good enough for you anyways.
It's the handy doctor.
It's the handy doctor.
In many ways.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I just found it didn't just make me angry. It severely disappointed me. And I literally stopped and turned it off, and it took me a couple of months to go back to watching Who again.
But see, here's the thing about Doctor Who fans. They get really angry, and it's like, I stopped watching it briefly. That's how angry I was. And then I went back because I have to catch up and know what's going on.
I limited myself to the Wikipedia page and that synopsis of the TV show. That's all the more I paid attention to it.
Doctor Who has made me angry many times, but I want to take us back to the mid-80s where I experienced my first fan rage when I didn't even know what a fan was. But I started watching Doctor Who when Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor, was on TV, and he was my doctor. I had no idea he wasn't a very popular doctor because I thought he was awesome. And this was before the internet, so the only news and gossip we would get was like once a month in Doctor Who magazine, and there'd be a couple paragraphs in the Gallifrey Guardian, which would be the news section of Doctor Who Monthly. And imagine my surprise one day opening my issue of Doctor Who magazine that I got at Schindler's. I'm an adolescent. I passed up all that porn and went straight to Doctor Who magazine, got it right off the shelf and took it home. And I read that Colin Baker had been fired. Sacked, as the British say. I had to figure that out. I got a little confused. They put him in a sack? That seems mean. I was outraged. I had just nothing but moral indignation and didn't know what to. There wasn't an internet to pour it into either, so I just sat alone in my room and yelled at my brother occasionally. But it still felt good. He was the early internet for me. And then I had a little flashback to it recently because apparently in Doctor Who Monthly magazine, recently they did a poll of who's your favorite doctor, and the Sixth Doctor came out at the very bottom. And Colin Baker expressed some sadness at being there, and a lot of people gave him some stick for it, for being a poor sport for saying anything. And again, I was like, you leave my doctor alone! So it's still in there, that adolescent anger somewhere.
I like the way Colin Baker's tirade against that has taken the form of being against any sort of poll that ranks the doctors. That's the issue that he's really chose to focus on. He thinks it's wrong just fundamentally to rank the doctors. It has nothing to do with where he ends up in those rankings.
It's when he starts applying it to the British electoral system that I'm worried about.
Well, and Colin Baker gets the unfortunate rap of also having some of the worst companions that Doctor Who has ever had, which never really helps him, I think, in that voting.
I think it was all about the coat, really.
But Colin Baker is a very nice fellow. We recently met him, and yeah, he was nothing but a gentleman. So back off of Colin Baker. Pat?
Well, you know, I this question is dear to my heart, but I wrote down and discarded a lot of things like, oh, the relationship with the Masters always kind of bothered me, the dumb ending of the demons, Leela leaving in the Invasion of Time. What I really wanted to talk about, but I'm not going to tonight, I'm not gonna, is the episode The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. And let me explain.
Oh, God.
So after Planet of the Dead, this is the thing that sent me into a towering rage. I hate it more than Hitler. So,
which is possible only for Whovian.
Right, but it needs
the scale of hate we're talking about.
We have a segment on the show called The Deadly Assassin, which we've only deployed once up to now, but we have many, many plans to do it again. And the last time I savaged Planet of the Dead, well, this, fellas, is the next one that I'm doing. So we're not going to talk about it tonight, but hey, in the future, listen for it.
I just want to say, when I wrote my review of Dr. Widow in the Wardrobe, I said, old school Whovians are going to say this is everything that's wrong with New Who. And I had exactly Pat Harrigan in mind when I wrote that.
You know me so well.
And he
well.
Knew it, and yeah, he jumped in on the comments and said, yup.
Yeah. If you Google middle-aged Doctor Who nerd, Pat pops up. He yeah, really does.
So
you don't even have to put American in front of it, which is funny.
So we're gonna put a pin in that for a later episode. And now, because much of Russell Davies, specifically the David Tennant years, just gave me a low-level anger throughout the entire thing, it was difficult to focus on a moment. But I chose one.
Okay.
It's New Earth. This is David Tennant's first second episode, first normal episode after the Christmas special. The resolution of this complicated and preposterous story is that he cures a bunch of people by dumping bags of different colored medicines on them.
Like you read about.
That's right. That's all I got. I'm speechless with rage. But more than even the stupidness of it was the suggestion, proven time and time again, that this is what the new Who was going to be. This is what it was going to be like. It was going to end with David Tennant sprinkling different colored things.
Fixing it with fairy dust.
Yeah. And then everything's better. Yeah. And that's how it was for like 4 years after that.
Yeah. That's some people's ideal version of Doctor Who, though. You have to know. It's like, I wish he dumped something on me.
takes all
Why
kinds.
Why can't the doctor give me drugs?
Yeah. Calvin has the floor.
Okay. The thing that made me angriest was another 10th Doctor era thing, and it was this one particular line. And now here's the problem. This line shocked and bothered me so much that it made my brain go blue screen of death, and I can't honestly remember what the line is. And I can't honestly remember what episode it was, whether it was Rose era, Martha era, Donna era, I don't remember. But all I remember is the line started out really good. I mean, the first half of the line was like everything that was really good about the Russell T. Davies era. It was this, you know, this very heartfelt, strong emotionalism and this grandeur of time and space and these kind of things. And the second half of the line was everything that was awful about the Russell T. Davies era. It was glib. It was self-congratulatory. It undercut everything that happened before. And I just, in a lot of ways, I can't remember exactly what it was I was just so shocked how you could have such a cool line and turn it into such a crappy line.
But what was the line?
I wish I could remember. I spent, seriously, this past week, I spent so much time online looking up Doctor Who quotes on the IMDb and everything else, just trying to figure out what the hell this line was, and I can't find it, and that's making me almost equally as mad.
Essentially, you just said that at some point, Doctor Who made you really angry, and that's really it?
No, it was a very specific moment, but it
you
was
can't remember.
Somewhere in the David Tennant
era. It burnt out my memory core.
There's a deep postmodern absence at the heart of your anger, Calvin.
It's
my husband
beautiful.
Claims that after Amy kissed the doctor that I threw the remote and said, no, I have no recollection of this. But I've seen the piece of the remote that is left, that exists.
So Doctor Who fans get really angry and tend to black out. So
yeah.
Is drinking involved? I don't know.
That only happens to me after Mark Gatiss episodes. So that's the only time I...
Well, tell us more.
No, I resisted the urge to go that route on answering this question. And instead I'll say what really, from a content standpoint, makes me angry is... And I suspect we could fill this in an hour on this question just talking about Stephen Moffat's writing of women. But Riversong, what he did to the character of Riversong is what has made me angriest in Doctor Who. Because he created this character in the beginning who was strong, who was independent, who was powerful, who was brilliant, who was the equal of the Doctor. And then over the next two seasons, he made it so she was only that way because of the Doctor. That she was this creation of the Doctor, that she was this stalker of the Doctor, that her entire identity was tied into the Doctor. And that really pissed me off.
Wow, that's really serious.
Sorry.
That was my number two choice, so thank you very
much. I was worried you were going to steal mine, so I was...
I almost did.
Well, maybe we should just remove women from Doctor Who, and then it just wouldn't be so complex, right?
I believe that's been tried.
You're right.
Yeah, we should be beyond gender at this point anyway.
So Doctor Who made you really angry once, right?
Yes. Yes, it did, and I wish I could remember the time it made me.
Now I just want to test lines on you and see if it was the right one.
It is like a popcorn husk stuck in my teeth. I just want to know what the hell was flying.
Was it from Voyage of the Damned?
I don't remember.
He really doesn't remember.
I really don't remember.
If he remembers, we'll put it online. We will post a link to
that. That might be part of my problem. It might have been from Voyage of the Damned, which didn't have it had Astrid Peth in it, so I don't have like a specific long-term companion to associate with it. Maybe that's a memory thing.
You don't remember the line, but you remember the name of the character Kylie Minogue played in Voyage of the Day.
Moving right along, we'd like to thank Ariel for joining us, everybody. Thank you for your anger.
So before we move to round three, let's introduce our critic for the evening, Ed Hike.
Hey, everybody. Can we get some house lights on Ed? We want him to sit in his natural habitat, the audience.
As you will note, I have a notebook and a pen and a pad. And just a little help from anyone. Abysmal, two L's, one L. Any ideas? All right, thank you. One L. So after watching the first 20 minutes or so, a few comments. It seems to be hurtling along like one of those mid-70s episodes, like episode 3, when they start corridor running about 5 minutes in, and then they corridor run for 10 minutes, and then they stop for a real info dump, and then they corridor run for the rest of it. So that's kind of how I'm feeling about the show so far.
Several of us are going to get imprisoned and then released from the prison and then put back in the cell, and that will...
At least 6 or 7 times, yes.
Yes.
So I'm thinking, I kind of have a mental scale with Time and the Ronnie at the very bottom and Pyramids of Mars at the very top. Mm-hmm. And right now, this is kind of running somewhere between the Armageddon factor, especially those last two episodes that have nothing to do with the rest of it, and those endless episodes in The Ambassadors of Death.
Wow.
So whose idea was it to bring the critic?
I think we can pull it out.
Yours, wasn't
it? it was.
I think we can pull it out, Josh.
All right, so we're going to maybe check back in with Ed later in the podcast. So let's give him a round of applause appropriate to a critic.
Yay! When do we get to criticize the critic? Is that later in the episode?
It's free for all at any point in time.
We're applauding two critics. It's kind of insane.
All right, that's you again, Kelvin.
It's me again.
He's like a 60s news anchor. He just needs a cigarette, and he's like, I don't know where I am.
Yeah. I can't read this teleprompter. Okay. Anyway, we're now up to round three, The Awakening. Yes. In this round, we find some poor, unfulfilled person who has never seen Doctor Who. And we make them watch one story from the classic series and one story from the new series to see if we can awaken his or her inner Doctor Who fan.
So tonight's Doctor Who newbie is one of the funniest people we know, Twin Cities actor and comedian Shannon Custer.
Hi.
We asked Shannon to watch the Tom Baker adventure, Destiny of the Daleks.
Yeah, that's one episode, but it's in 4 parts.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We didn't
I just want to make that clear.
Did they not tell you that, Shannon?
Nope. Mm-hmm. Nope. Not till I clicked on the link.
And also the Matt Smith episode, Asylum of the Daleks.
Yes, from 2012.
Oh, she's been studying.
I have so many notes.
So
I really do.
So let me tell the nerds in the audience a little of what we were thinking by having you watch your first ever episode of Doctor Who as Destiny of the Daleks. Now, what we wanted to do was kind of recreate our experience with Doctor Who, which is, you know, again, before the age of the internet. It was before curated television. You just happened to turn something on, and if it was crazy and made no sense, you either turned it off or were intrigued, and you had to slowly but surely figure it out. You couldn't go to Wikipedia. You couldn't watch it in chronological order on Netflix. And Destiny of the Daleks was picked at random.
Well, and I didn't do any Google searches. I really did try to embrace being Joshua at the age of 10. That was...
I hope you didn't totally embrace it.
No. I know. Halfway through that sentence, I was like, back up!
Did you call my brother and scream at him?
Yeah, I did.
So, Shannon, did you know anything about Doctor Who?
No. And it's not some reason. I don't have some... this isn't some political thing. I didn't ever just... You know, it was never, I will never watch your show, fools. You know, it was never that. I just didn't.
You had a college run-in with Doctor Who. You told me this story.
Yes, I did. I had this scarf, a really long scarf. Because I used to wear a really long sweater. I had this weird 70s thing going in college because I was so angry. And this guy, my dear friend, Mike Parker, came up to me. He's like, hey, doctor. Like, something like that. And I was like, what? And then it was over. But I remembered it very specifically for this. And he was, that was very funny. You know, 22 years later, I should probably tell him, nice one. Because that was exactly what it looked like. It had to loop a couple times, and yeah.
Oh, there's nothing like the 20-year zing. Yeah.
Remember that time? No? Okay. So, I'm Shannon. Yeah.
Before we dig into the actual stories here, yeah. can you tell us a little about your experience once people knew you were watching Doctor Who? Because I've experienced at least one or two reactions to the fact that you were watching Doctor Who.
It's very interesting. I feel like I've walked into some sort of...
cult. You can say it.
Okay.
It's fine.
Let's say that. Just as a hypothetical. No, but there's been very... people have private messaged me so that you wouldn't see and you couldn't, you know, bring in your own little opinions. And they were like, you just be careful. That's what... I mean, it was a lot of that. And then how... And then in all sincerity, the arc of you're just going to hate this... to, you know, well, it's not as bad as you might think, which is, I think, actually worse. I would rather hate it than be like, that wasn't so bad, you know. But being a casual Doctor Who watcher, which apparently we have one in the audience, which I don't believe, because I think that's like being a casual heroin user. You know, like, yeah, it's here. But I won't want it tomorrow. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Social heroin user. But yeah, being here tonight even and listening, I've sort of flop sweated out a little bit because it's like listening to The Current. Does this play in England? Do they know what that is? I'm convinced that, you know,
we have one download from North Korea.
Okay,
so
the alternative music station. But, you know, I just feel like they're just saying things in the room. You know, they're like, that was Dry Erase Board with their new single, Pencil Leak. You know, like, I don't know what's happening on that station. But I listen to it out of guilt. And I... oh no, this has become something else. Well, anyway, so that's what it's felt like, all of your words coming out of your mouth.
Okay, well, why don't you give us some words to describe your first experience, which was Destiny of the Daleks.
Yes.
Your first encounter with the Doctor was Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor.
Who is Neil Gaiman and Tom Jones' love child.
That's
yes.
That took me a second, and then once it happened, I just felt warm. And this is fascinating, by the way, because I've watched Neverwhere and I've read it. And that guy is the new Doctor. So in. I didn't know that. But yeah, I thought it was very funny, actually. in that way that, like, you want to just hear one crew member laugh. You know, like, that's good. You know? But it's so quiet. But, like, I like the moment when he's like, oh, look, rocks. I wrote all of this stuff down. Underworld Dentist would be a really good band name. But I thought he was very charming. Yeah. And it's with, oh my goodness, what's her name?
Lala Ward.
Romana, right?
Lala Ward.
Yeah, but she comes out and all these, like, all these different people come out.
So
he's
for
like, too tall.
Anyone in the audience who hasn't seen Destiny of the Daleks recently, it opens with Romana's regeneration, where it's portrayed very comically, where she tries on a lot of bodies. So this is the first episode we let Shannon watch. Yeah.
Too tall, take it away.
Did you get what was happening?
No, absolutely not. Okay. But there was one that looked like a Vegas showgirl, mm-hmm. And then there was a Greek goddess one, and then I actually wrote, these are callbacks. That's what I wrote.
Maybe, yes.
Because he was like, not you, and I was like, oh, what are you talking about? I had no idea what was
my favorite line from that scene, though, is when the Vegas showgirl comes out, and Tom Baker looks at her, then looks away quickly, and he says, no thank you, but he's a smart man. He leaves it open. He says, not today.
Not
like,
today.
Maybe later. Let's see how this whole Dalek thing turns out. I might need you later.
We might revisit that body later. Yeah.
Shannon, would it surprise you to learn that in the very previous episode, Ramana had been played by a totally different actress?
Really?
Yes.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes, it would.
Would it also surprise you to learn that Lala Ward played a completely different character than Ramana in the previous episode?
Well, didn't it play for like 3,000 episodes? I mean, eventually you're just going to be like, just put this hat on. Be someone else.
Shannon, would it surprise you to learn that the episode you watched was basically the worst introduction to Doctor Who that could possibly have had?
Oh, really? Oh, well, I feel like I did pretty well then.
Yeah,
I have some questions about the Daleks.
Okay, fire away. Yes. We have some Dalek experts in the house.
Okay, good, because one of the first things I wrote down was, are they, like, stormtroopers? Are there people inside? Okay.
Really, Shannon?
Shut up, because
really?
I didn't know.
They're,
you know,
they're like mutant blob things in little tanks.
Because they're so adorable. They're super cranky, but I mean, they're just mad. But you just want to be like, oh, yeah, I'd be mad too. You're so cute. But then the Davros guy, he was like, I was saying, he was reminding me of Mr. Potter on It's a Wonderful Life. He was like, and he's like super mad.
That's a wonderful comparison.
Yeah. He's like, no.
Would it surprise you to find out that the actor who portrayed Davros in that episode was the most toned-down, mild-mannered Davros of them all?
No.
It's true. It's not the same first actor who played Davros, and they couldn't make a whole new costume and makeup for him, so they had to kind of jam him into the old costume, and he was like a much taller man, so it was like very... It didn't quite mesh right.
Sure, But yeah, he's very grumpy. And then it goes all the way to the episode where they play rock, paper, scissors, and I thought that was hysterical.
I think it's very funny. Awkwardly, I say that.
Yeah.
So did you find it funny in a, I'm enjoying this funny, or, oh my gosh, this is hilarious, seen from outside my timeline?
Based on all the private messages I was getting, I was really surprised at how much fun it was. People were just, I mean, there were people who were actually concerned for me. Like, they were like, you are going to lose hope, and it's going to be bad, and you'll never, you know, and I thought it was pretty good. It reminded, you know, it's like, I think Land of the Lost is really good, so maybe that's not a good, you know, I mean, it makes me warm inside, even though, you know, it's not that, yeah, but yeah.
Did you have any thoughts about the Movellans?
I had so many thoughts. Oh my God, they're beautiful.
AKA the Rick Jones, the Rick James clones aboard the Federation Starship Super Freak.
Yes. Or I thought they were like fans of Sia. Or also, they also reminded me of the Diane Carroll character in the Star Wars holiday special. You can Google that.
Oh my God.
Because I did and posted the picture. But yeah, no, I loved them. Also, I mean, just thinking as a performer, those white suits, not okay. Those were some toned people.
They're not forgiving outfits.
Yeah, no, they were very sweet. I mean, I did like them a lot. Is that what you were asking?
Yes.
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up to the Movellans. Okay, can we transition to the Matt Smith 2012 Asylum of the Daleks? That's a big jump in time.
That was kind of unfair, actually. Because I had no idea. There's a lot of infrastructure in comparison. But what I will say is, the Doctor, this is the 11th Doctor.
A round of applause. Yeah.
Wow.
I did not Google that. That's just from listening to the conversations in the room. Yeah, he's George McFly. He looks exactly like George McFly. I mean, he really does.
It's frightening,
with
but
the
true.
Bow tie and the... But I thought he was really nice. It was so... But there were... I was telling Ariel
this. The most
this.
Minnesotan review of Doctor Who I've ever heard.
No, I was telling Ariel about this, that there were some references, though, that I got from seeing the four parts of, and one of them was the zombie when he says you're cold, and I screamed at my laptop, "Just a zombie!" Like I screamed it. I was alone, and I screamed, "That's a zombie!" Is that the first step? And then there was that souffle girl, Osmond.
Yeah, Oswin.
Oswin. Sorry. Yeah, she's like the Penelope Garcia of. Anybody? Criminal Minds? No?
No.
I'm alone. She was just like online. And then she finds out she's a dolly. That was sad. Very sad. She had this lovely life. She had those cute red tennis shoes and the red dress. And she was making souffles, talking to her mom. And then they're like, snap. You are nothing. And then she tries to kill him, but she's like, I don't want to. But she did. Ah, you guys.
So it's emotionally a very different experience
well,
for you.
Well, I think what it is that they, it felt like they went deeper into the emotional side of being a Dalek as opposed to being a super tall, angry R2-D2.
That's a nice encapsulation of the differences between the classic and the new series.
Like they dealt with it on an emotional level. You know, people were sad and alone.
People get sad in the new Doctor Who.
And it was
Who.
Like kind of, oh, is this going to be bad? But it was like the Borg in my, I mean, if I was going to grab any metaphor and just hold on for dear life because I'm alone, I am drowning. That would be my metaphor was that it was like the Borg, like 7 of 9 kind of thing. Only less hot. I don't know what I mean. I don't know what's going on. But yeah.
So the big question here is were you intrigued enough by this to watch
have we won you
further episode? Because that's why we titled this round The Awakening. We may do this again. We're going to see, have we awakened the inner Doctor Who fan in Shannon?
I will tell you, in all sincerity, if I was going to watch, I would watch the old one. Because I follow rules, you know, like I was an RA. Like I just, I would hate to go into the new one. That would feel like cheating.
So you think you would watch every episode?
But then there's not enough time.
No.
I mean, I would have to quit some jobs. I'd have to, like, you know, have someone care for my daughter. There would be a lot that I'd have to, like,
You should also know that 4 is not the longest number of episodes for a story in classic Doctor Who.
Wow. And then
so you need to really think about
and
this.
And I also heard about these lost ones and books and...
Audio,
stuff that
audio
this one
plays,
guy has,
books,
and you got to know the word, and then
stage plays,
the stage plays,
1960s feature films.
Yeah, and that's when I get a little concerned.
So that's where we've landed. We didn't turn you into a fan, but we turned you into a casual and heroine-esque Doctor Who fan.
Yeah.
A round of applause for Shannon Custer. Before we move to the next round, believe it or not, Calvin and I have some letters that were addressed to Peter Capaldi, but we got our grubby paws on them.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Calvin, would you like to read yours?
Okay, sure. Mine's a little beer-stained and burned with cigarette ashes, but let me see what I can do with this one. Yo, eyebrow guy. That limey sci-fi show you're in ain't half bad. But me and the boys down at the docks got a few suggestions as how to move your cute little monster show from the merely decent to the truly great. 1. Talk normal. What is that, Scottish or something? Who's Scottish these days? It ain't the way what peoples who talk good talk, you know what I mean? 2. Relax. Grab a good meal. Take it a ball game. Who don't love a ball game? Nobody, I know, that's for sure. 3. Shred that axe some more. Now we're talking. Blow them pepper pots away with some good old American rock and roll. Might I suggest Motley Crue or The Boss? 4. More ass kicking. Time Lords got asses, don't they? So kick some. Get some companions with the appropriate ass kicking skill set. I understand Stallone is looking for work these days. 5. Neck tattoos. 6. K9 Mark 3 or 4 or whatever, but
But this time, he ain't one of them little yappy old lady dogs, but like a real man's dog, you know what I mean? You know, like a labradoodle. But to reiterate, not a half bad show. Most sincerely and respectfully, Lou. P.S. World Cup 2016, England 1, U.S. of A. 4. Am I right or am I right?
Woo!
We may have read these letters in the wrong order. I do not have a funny voice for this letter, but it is rather insightful nonetheless. Dear Mr. Capaldi, I am writing in regards to a recent addition to your Doctor Who wardrobe. I am, of course, referring to your hooded sweatshirt, or as today's young hooligans like to call it, hoodie. These are the same ne'er-do-wells and street urchins who insist on soiling their classic American underpants with the childish term tidy-whities, not to mention giving you the ridiculous nickname P-Cap. But I digress. I am writing to respectfully request you never again don that heinous hooded abomination. While I recognize this type of athleisure wear is popular with kids and the unemployed, I feel it is highly inappropriate attire for a 2,000-year-old Time Lord, even a highly active one such as yourself. Can you imagine other doctors wearing this kind of nonsense? Tom Baker dashing down corridors in nothing but form-fitting 70s running shorts? Using his scarf to cover his unsightly bulges like some mad, boggle-eyed Lady Godiva? Or perhaps it's easier for you to picture Colin Baker huffing away on his exercise bike in a neon pink sports bra and a billowy pair of tiger-striped Zumbas. On second thought, a bra might have given poor Colin Baker some much-needed support. God knows he didn't get any from the viewing public. But once again, I digress. If your intent in adopting sports attire is to promote healthy living, I suggest you take inspiration from your fifth incarnation and wear a leafy boutonniere of your choosing. While a nutritious stalk of celery looked dashing on Peter Davison's lapel, I feel your fiercer take on the role demands a darker, more antioxidant-rich vegetable such as kale, or even a tasteful arrangement of Swiss chard. In closing, your sartorial style and elegance was a highlight of not just Series 8, but the new series as a whole. I implore you to jettison your hoodie from the TARDIS like you once did Ramana's bedroom. And no, Stephen Moffat, jettison is not a euphemism. If you don't stop dressing down now, I fear this year's Christmas special will feature the debut of your new yoga pants, complete with a fanny pack to hold your sonic screwdriver. And no, Stephen Moffat, none of that sentence was a euphemism. A dear friend of mine once summed up the second half of the 20th century thusly. First they shot Kennedy, then men started wearing t-shirts in public. After that, everything went to hell. Peter Capaldi, please don't go to hell. Sincerely, Joshua English Scrimshaw.
Okay, so we're moving on to round four, but first, Josh, do you think you could read that part about Colin Baker in a pink sports bra again? Slowly. So round four, Special Topics Dalek, part two. This time, we ask the question, has Doctor Who ever made you cry?
Joining us for this round is super sensitive man actor, Clarence Weathers.
Hi. Thank you.
Clarence, has Doctor Who ever made you cry?
You know, I was thinking about that, and I can without reservation say that Battlestar Galactica has. Star Trek The Next Generation has, for sure. Doctor Who's come close. So the classic series has such a flat affect anyway. There's so little emotion going on in it. The new series is so manipulative emotionally that it kind of bounces off. But there are instances where I've definitely come close. But they've all been new series, I think.
Are you sure you're a super sensitive man actor?
Compared to the other people in the room.
So if you were even more sensitive, is there some place that Doctor Who would make you cry?
So you should have
asked
me.
Where in your body would Doctor Who make you cry?
If you'd asked me 10 years ago, I before my soul died, I would have been able to tell you, but I'm in my 30s now. I just recently, we're rewatching it now. We're in the Donna season of the new series. And when just Bernard Cribbins as her grandfather sees her off. And it's mainly because, first of all, it's a relationship that you never have seen on the show before. And it's refreshing, and it's also really lovely and very very well acted. And it's a departure from what's come before, especially off of two consecutive companions who they've tried to go to the romance well for, which just doesn't work. And this was just an adult woman who, and this was her grandfather, and he just wanted to see her go off and do something. And she's waving at him from the TARDIS as they fly off, and he's, you know, you're tearing up now just listening to it. I know. It's and again, it's, I think it's really lands on Bernard Cribbins' performance, because he does such a great job of just being just this raw nerve of joy and love and excitement. You know, so that really, that moment just kind of welled up in me a little.
Welled
bit.
Up very close.
Very close.
So, ladies and gentlemen, an old English guy almost made Clarence cry. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. By the way, Kelvin, I think I might have figured out what your line was
okay. That
you hated so much. From Voyage of the Damned, because, again, I just watched this.
All right.
I want to run this by you.
Okay.
If we have time. I mean, you can
stop
me.
Yeah.
Stop, please!
We don't want to talk about Doctor Who. So, okay, in Voyage of the Damned, when everyone's like arguing because the ship is sinking or whatever, and he says, right, then follow me, and the rich says, hang on a minute, who put you in charge, and who the hell are you anyway? And he says, I'm the Doctor. I'm a Time Lord. I'm from the planet Gallifrey in the constellation of Gasterbus. I'm 903 years old, and I'm the man who's going to save your lives and all 6 billion people on the planet below. You got a problem with that? No. In that case, allons-y. Was that it? Because that sounds just that like was, what that, you were describing.
That was not it.
Okay.
But
I'm glad you didn't stop me then.
But it is a line that super typifies the 10th Doctor era.
Because you said it started really rousing and very doctory, and then turns on a dime and becomes
wanky. It wasn't like the mean, forceful kind of doctory. It was the more like, look at the amazement of the universe kind of doctrine.
We'll let this out.
Back well, if it helps Clarence, it pissed me off.
That's what I thought.
That is, coincidentally, though, a speech that makes me cry, so it fits this.
There it is.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right, so I thought the idea of Doctor Who making you cry was a lot of malarkey, because the old series never was touching at all.
No, I mean, that's explicitly, like, what it always comes down to, the people that I know who were fans of the old series, who dislike the new series or scoff at it, it all comes down to the treatment of the emotional journey of the characters. Because that is the only real difference.
Yeah.
Because people talk about stuff they think is stupid in the new series. The old series was stupid. There was plenty of stupid, but it wasn't so
manipulative. But never once would you have to use the term emotional journey to describe
it. Exactly.
Next special topics round is when is Doctor Who made you want to throw up? That'll be it.
So, and I think that's the central difference between the two, is that this one is much more focused on that sort of how this land on them internally, that they're going on this journey through time and space and meeting Silurians. How would they feel about that?
But it's
very bombastic and manipulative too. That is, you know, goes a little too far as well. But
resistant to that. I thought I had. There's nothing that the new series could throw at me in an emotionally manipulative way that could make water come out of these old angry eyes.
Why is my face leaking?
But we were watching together as a family. I can't remember what episode it was, but it was when Matt Smith calls to talk to the Brigadier and finds out he's died.
Yeah.
And the actor has actually passed away. And it was this unexpected moment for me. Fortunately, because new Doctor Who is super boring, my entire family had fallen asleep at this point. And they're sitting there snoring, and I'm sitting alone as he calls to talk to the Brigadier and finds out that he died peacefully in his sleep, which is a reference to Battlefield, which is a reference to our title of the podcast, Get Off My World, and a little tiny tear. It's okay.
And see, they took advantage, instead of trying to soar this Murray Gold score and have this bombastic monologue, that was so touching because they banked on the fact that they have 50 years of investment. Yep. That you cared about the Brigadier.
Yep, they were like,
that's
Scrimshaw's watching. Let's humiliate him.
Well, it didn't work because his family was asleep.
Yes. So that's my one-tier moment, Pat.
Well, I don't think Doctor Who has ever made me cry because I am also
a monster,
a stone. but I will confess to misting up a little bit. I had to reach for this one though. There, I really had to kind of dig deep, and I came up with a few things like Joe leaving at the end of the Green Death.
That was really effective.
It's good.
It's the most emotional farewell in the original series, probably.
Companions leaving should always be an emotional moment, but virtually never are
unless they're Ramon. Right.
That was great. The relationship between the First Doctor and Barbara always kind of gets me on some sort of strange level. I just like their relationship. It's very comfortable and very kind, and I can't explain it more than that. I don't weep whenever I see them talk to each other, but I like it on an emotional level. And then as far as the new series goes, Father's Day from the first Christopher Eccleston season, the Paul Cornell episode, is always just a good, solid tearjerker. Except, of course, you've got Murray Gold's terrible score trying to jerk every last tear out of you, and it's just layered with lots of junk over the top of it. So it'd be better without it, but, you know.
That was my runner-up.
I still cry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And finally, I just thought of this while we were talking, actually. I'd forgotten how much I do like some of the Christmas specials, and I did like the Michael Gambon Christmas Carol one, and a lot of that was just him as the guest actor and the relationship with the Doctor in a tried and true Charles Dickens story done in the Doctor Who universe. Mm. So those things will get me to mist up a little.
Mist up a little. So nothing actually leaves your eyes. You just, your vision becomes momentarily blurred. How do you separate that from anger? Because that sounds a lot like what happened to Calvin.
Well, sometimes it's hard. Like in
the same.
Yeah, when he meets Vincent Van Gogh, that episode, which is supposed to just like make you cry, or whatever. No, it just made me angry.
Oh, I totally forgot about that one. I did well up during that scene in the art museum at the end. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay, doctors made me come close to crying a lot more than I thought.
You're more sensitive than we thought, Clarence.
Yeah, Calvin.
Again, I never flat out cried.
You inhuman monster.
I know. But I have an interesting thing. In The End of Time, which is the last 10th Doctor one, right?
Did correct. That?
Okay. Okay, it has the very, very prolonged goodbye, but which I think was self-defeating. But very early on, when he is confronting Rassilon just before he starts to die, and Rassilon is with these other Time Lords, and there's this, it's never explicitly stated in the script or anything, but it's pretty clear that one of the Time Lords is the Doctor's mom. And he just kind of notices her, and he's like, oh my God. Because he's like, look, he's probably never seen his mom in like 900 years. You know, he's like, well, I still got to defeat Rassilon here, and kind of moves on. That kind of hit me.
Aw.
Yeah.
Michael?
What a bunch of cold-hearted bastards you are. I mean, okay, so I will say, first of all, that, you know, the part I left out of my introduction was that my role here is to be the new Who fan in this sea of old Who defenders. But I well up all the time. Yeah. And the thing about emotional manipulation is that even when you recognize it's emotional manipulation, it still works on me. It doesn't, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It totally works. My answer has already been mentioned. It was Vincent and the Doctor. The end of Vincent and the Doctor.
Yeah.
Wrecks me. Absolutely wrecks me every time.
Oh, that one really got me. Yeah.
I think partially it works because you know it's not a happy ending. It's not going to be a happy ending. And Amy Pond runs into that museum thinking it's going to be a happy ending and thinking that they changed this guy's life, and it wrecks me every time.
Yeah. Yeah. One I forgot too is the empty child and Doctor dances, everybody lives, that moment.
That was a good one.
Yeah, when he's just so overcome with joy that an adventure was completed and everybody lived, and it was so rare, and this is coming off of the fact that he just has committed this horrible crime by destroying Gallifrey in the Time War, and he's carrying the survivor's guilt.
Spoilers.
Yeah, well, that's how the series starts.
Yeah.
I didn't spoil. Now I'm about to. Never mind. I'll stop talking.
Can I change my answer? Yeah.
Go ahead.
And he's just so happy at that moment.
Yeah, yes. That's it. It's just like
you don't often get happy tears in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I forgot. I cried a little during an adventure in time and space. But we'll talk about that on a future podcast.
Okay. I think there's more tears to come, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Let's thank Clarence Weathern.
Thank you.
All right, let's check back in with Ed. Can we get lights up on this guy and see if his opinion has changed in the podcast thus far?
Well, after the most recent segment, I changed my mind a bit. I had written down, seems like a Murray Gold sort of podcast, but now it's more like a Dudley Simpson kind podcast.
Yes.
Just to note, what makes me cry inside all the time about Doctor Who is that Peter Cushing is not considered canon. I want that to change. Peter Cushing should be one of the doctors. Call him Doctor 1A, whatever you want to do. Important. Thank you. Important contribution.
One fan.
Yes.
There's a reason Ed's in the audience.
And I guess if I were to put this in my scale I talked about before, because of Shannon's first encounter here, I think it kind of fits somewhere between Ghostlight and that first episode of The Mind Robber where nothing really makes sense, but it's really, really cool. So,
Shannon, that's impressive, just so you know. That's yeah, everybody. Thank you.
Mind Robber reference, awesome.
Okay, guys, it is time for our Fast and Furious final round, and we're going to change things up. So first of all, let me just get all the guests onto the stage right now. Let's do it.
Look at them all. Holy crud. I didn't realize this many people listened to our show.
All right, grab a seat, Ed. Here's what we're going to do. This is going to be a lightning round version of the Deadly Assassin, which means one person is going to defend an episode of Doctor Who from an assassin. And just to mix things up here, the person selecting the actual episodes is going to be someone who is utterly ignorant of them. Shannon, we have a list of every single episode of Doctor Who, and Shannon is going to pick it based on her utter ignorance, on whatever amuses her. And then Pat is going to use his encyclopedic knowledge of Doctor Who, minus the number of beers he's had tonight, to quickly recap the episode for the audience here. And then I will assign an attacker and a defender who will have a limited amount of time based entirely on my opinion of their argument. So, are we ready? All right, Shannon, pick an episode.
Okay, the Happiness Patrol.
It's a funny title.
It's adorable.
The Happiness Patrol is a Sylvester McCoy episode that is a 1980s Margaret Thatcher allegory that has a giant man made out of licorice.
You just know that?
That's really, really good.
Did
All
that
right.
just happen? Well, like I would
All right.
know.
Who wants
you
to attack?
Anything.
Clarence is attacking. Who's defending? Ariel's defending.
I had a feeling
Clarence,
she might.
Start.
It is sort of the nadir of 80s Doctor Who and its death throes, where the production value is so much at the bottom, and I don't have a whole lot for this.
Clarence is wrong. I chose poorly,
apparently.
Candyman! The Candyman is terrible!
The Candyman is actually kind of great because there's two kinds of warnings about the political system that are happening within this episode. One is warning you against that which presents everything as happy and sweet and cheerful and cute, and one that is warning you that if you aren't happy and cheerful and sweet and cute, we're going to kill you.
And they do that for four episodes straight without elaborating.
But they've got great harmonica.
All right, audience, who's the winner? Is it Clarence? Round of applause. Okay, just mocking laughter for Clarence and for Ariel.
Yay! Oh.
Seventh Doctor fan.
It's because you're so mad.
Yeah.
Next you're
like episode,
a Dalek.
Shannon.
Dalek.
I shouldn't have attacked
Damn
that
it.
One.
Son of a...
I jumped on that grenade for everybody else.
Okay. Vampires of Venice.
Ooh, alliteration. Pat.
There are vampires in Venice.
Yes.
That makes...
Michael's going to defend. Ugh. Ed's going to attack.
There's vampires in Venice. I mean, what else do you need to say about this episode? It has some really strange, hand-wavy science fiction plot. There's water everywhere, and none of it makes sense. And Rory and Amy are also on some sort of strange in the middle of the bachelor party date so they'll get back together and Amy won't want to date the doctor. Come on.
That sounds like a defense to me, but still, defend it.
Okay, I will defend it. First of all, the episode starts with Matt Smith jumping out of a cake at a wedding. That's all the defense the episode needs, right there.
Yeah.
Second of all, it's a perfectly adequate mid-level story, Doctor Who. Third of all, there are some very beautiful vampire chicks in the episode.
Nice.
For a Doctor Who episode, this is high defense.
That's all I got.
No,
I really can't tell who is attacking and who is defending. But needless to say, who thinks Ed won? Not many people. Man, people hate a critic. I'm just being honest. Who thinks that Michael won? We have a very positive audience here. Let's see if we can turn this around and get some negative winners. Shannon.
Okay. The doctor, the widow, and the wardrobe.
Oh, dear.
Pat, recap without attacking it.
I can't even.
Is it? Oh, did I choose poorly?
All right, it just makes Pat super angry. So I'm gonna have Pat actually attack it, and I will have Kelvin defend.
You can't see at home, but he's shrugging.
Come on, you know it's heartwarming. It's Christmas. It's
It's a Christmas one. I'm so happy.
It's a Christmas one. It's referencing Narnia, a story everyone loves, and it's about World War II and the sacrifices people made in that. Am I mixing up my stories?
Just commit to it.
No, you're right.
Go.
You're right.
Okay, it's about the sacrifices are the fighting men of Britain made in World War II and the struggles of the families they left behind and it's just come on, that's Christmas.
Yeah, it is. You just sum that up.
You got Shannon on your side at least.
Yeah, that's real.
Take it down, Pat.
So mad.
Use your words.
It's the worst form of emotional manipulation, regardless of how effective it might be to some people. It's a clone of an obvious story that everybody knows. It has no emotional truth to it. It undermines the logic of even its own story by just bringing somebody back from the dead that has no reason for him to come back. It has a planet full of living Christmas trees for no other reason than to give a kind of cheesy environmental message to the entire thing.
Also beautiful.
I forgot about the living Christmas trees. Those are cool.
But see, they're already living. I mean, trees live.
Well, they grow their Christmas own trees ornaments and seeds.
They're walking around.
I think Ed actually wrote down some of the things you said, and we're going to see it in a review, an ugly review.
Do you have a final statement, Pat, before we take it to a vote?
All right. Kill a puppy.
So Pat made a baby Dalek sound, whatever argument that constitutes. So are you going to vote for Calvin or the guy who hates Christmas? Calvin.
Yay!
Pat. And Pat wins.
It feels so cold in here.
Can we thank all of our guests here tonight with a big round of applause? Thank you guys so much.
Oh, let's kill Hitler. I could have chosen that one.
I would attack that.
I needed more time with the list. I'm
the
sorry.
The problem is everyone loves it. It's so predictable.
How can you not kill Hitler? I mean, really.
Guys, we'd like to thank all you guys for coming out, all of our guests. We'd like to thank the Bryant Lake Bowl. We'd like to thank Barb and the tech booth. We would like to thank Tony on our sound equipment right here. We would like to thank our lovely waitress. And everybody here, once again, one more round for all of our guests who just watched a lot of Doctor Who. Thank you so much. Pat, do you have a final letter for us?
I do. I have one final letter to Peter Capaldi. Dear Mr. Capaldi, I am writing to wish you luck as you embark on your new season as Doctor Who. This remarkable program, infamous for its preposterous plots, laughable special effects, clunky dialogue, wooden acting, general childishness, and astonishing lapses in taste, has been a British institution for over 50 years and is now a bona fide international smash hit.
I should say that it was from my own viewing of Doctor Who as a child that I was first exposed to concepts such as torture, genocide, fascism, race hatred, body horror, and Matthew Waterhouse. But we all learn of such things eventually. And it might as well be alongside a skepticism toward authority, a preference for negotiation instead of force, and a love of eccentricity and humor. Most admirable of all, though, is the program's shambolic, enthusiastic momentum, which demonstrated to me that even if one does not have the right tools for the job, say you need to film a half-hour program and you have only 20 quid and a giant pink snake, or you must fill an hour and a half of theater with nothing but your own hot air, well, by God, you go ahead and you do your job anyway. Best of luck, Mr. Capaldi. This letter is unsigned.
Thank you, everybody. Until next time, I am Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying,
everybody, get off my world.
Thank you. Good night.